Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking on something pretty big and honestly often really misunderstood, behaviorism.
Yeah, it definitely carries some baggage, doesn't it? People hear behaviorism and, you know, they often jump straight to maybe old experiments or simple reward charts.
Exactly. So our goal here is to kind of peel back those layers, look past the easy dismissals.
Right, and really get into the rigorous evidence-based science behind it today. We're drawing heavily from the work of Dr. Ronald Martella and Dr. Nancy Marcia Martella.
And their work, sort of inspired by discussions around things like grit and growth mindsets, it offers a really different frame.
It does.
So the big question for this deep dive is, what if behaviorism isn't really about blaming someone for, like, not having enough willpower,
mm-hmm.
but more about maybe scientifically setting up their environment so they can actually succeed?
That's the core shift, precisely. The Martellas, they're BCBAD's board-certified behavior analysts at the doctoral level. We're talking over 40 years of experience.
Wow.
Yeah, across really diverse and, frankly, intense settings, like think traumatic brain injury units, severe emotional disturbances.
Okay.
But also large-scale education stuff, like PBIS, RTI, MTSS. So really practical application. And their view is grounded in B.F. Skinner's work, going way back to 53.
So we're going to try and unpack the real definitions, especially reinforcement. We'll tackle some of those persistent myths. The Skinner box one is huge.
Oh, yeah. That one just won't die.
Right. And look at how behaviorists actually think about things like motivation and even, you know, what's going on inside our heads.
Let's start with the basics then, because the language itself, that's often the first hurdle, isn't it?
Definitely.
Okay, so the fundamental piece in operant behaviorism, it's the relationship between what you do and what happens next, the consequence.
The famous three-term contingency.
That's the one. You have the discriminative stimulus, the SD, that's the cue, basically.
Yes.
It sets the stage for the response, the behavior itself.
And then the crucial part, the reinforcer follows.
Yes. And this brings us straight to that first really vital distinction. We need to be careful with our words. Reinforcer, not reward.
Ah, okay. Explain that, because people use reward all the time.
They do, but scientifically it's different. Reinforcement or punishment, they are defined operationally. That means purely by their effect on future behavior.
Future behavior. Got it.
So a reinforcer must increase the chance of that behavior happening again. A punisher must decrease it.
So it's purely about the data, the outcome. If I give my kid praise for cleaning their room, but they don't clean it more often in the future,
then technically speaking, that praise did not function as a reinforcer in that instance. It might have been intended as one.
But it didn't work that way.
Right. We just call it a reward, something given after a behavior that may or may not change it. It takes the guesswork and, frankly, the judgment out of it.
This leads to some really counterintuitive examples, like the one the Martellas use about spanking.
Mm-hmm. It's a tough example, but it makes the point clearly. If a parent spanks a child for, say, talking back, but the talking back increases afterwards,
then the spanking weirdly functioned as what?
A positive reinforcer. Positive just means a stimulus was added to the spank. Reinforcer means the behavior it followed the talking back increased.
Wow. Okay, that forces you to look purely at the function, not the intent or the perceived unpleasantness.
Exactly. What is actually maintaining that behavior? That's the question.
Okay, so that careful definition is key. Let's hit misconception one then. Behaviorism gets called outdated stimulus response, SR, psychology all the time.
Yeah, and that's just flat wrong. SR psychology is really about classical conditioning, Pavlov's dogs, that sort of thing. Involuntary reflexes. Light shines in your eye. Pupil constricts. That's SR.
Automatic stuff.
Right. Operant conditioning, which is what behavior analysis mainly deals with, is about voluntary actions. It's more accurately SRS, stimulus, response, stimulus. The stimulus that follows the response is critical.
So the behavior is sort of emitted by the organism and then shaped by what happens next.
Precisely. It's not just pulled out by what came before. It's selected by its consequences.
Okay, let's shift to some of the heavier stuff. The ethical and historical baggage. Misconception two, behaviorism pushes punishment, maybe even abusively.
Yeah, the field definitely has a history to acknowledge, but modern behavior analysis is heavily regulated against that.
How so?
Well, ethical codes for BCBAs are really strict. They emphasize positive reinforcement first, always. Using punishment or aversives is seen as a last resort.
But I mean, in tough situations, like a really chaotic classroom, isn't punishment sometimes the quickest fix?
It might seem like it suppresses behavior quickly, but the focus is on building alternative desired behaviors through reinforcement. You design the environment so the positive behaviors pay off.
So you make the good behavior more likely, more rewarding.
Exactly. If a student is busy succeeding with a behavior that gets reinforced, they can't simultaneously be doing the problem behavior. The goal is always reinforcement maximization. Even Skinner argued back in the 50s that we need to move away from punishment.
That focus on designing the environment, it brings us to misconception three, the big one, the Skinner box daughter myth.
Yes. The zombie lie of behaviorism. It just keeps coming back.
So the story goes.
The story goes that B.F. Skinner raised his daughter, Deborah, in an experimental chamber, a Skinner box. And because of this, she supposedly suffered severe psychological harm. Sometimes the story says she sued him. Sometimes that she killed herself.
Which is completely false.
100% false. Skinner did invent something called the baby tender, or the air crib. It was basically a climate-controlled crib.
For comfort, not experiments.
Exactly. Porous mattress so the baby wouldn't suffocate. Warm filtered air so you didn't need heavy blankets. It was about safety and comfort and innovation, he thought.
And his daughter, Deborah.
Deborah Skinner Bouzon. She's alive and well, an artist, and has spent decades publicly refuting this story. She's written articles, given interviews, saying she had a perfectly normal, loving childhood.
So where did the terrible story come from?
It's often a mix-up, sometimes maybe confusing her with John B. Watson's granddaughter, Mariette Hartley, the actress, who did speak publicly about family struggles. But the Skinner part is pure fiction, probably fueled by unease about behaviorism itself.
It really shows how powerful a negative narrative can be, yeah, even when it's totally untrue. Okay, let's turn inward now. Misconception four. Behaviorism just ignores motivation.
Also false. But we look at motivation differently, not as some internal, unobservable trait like desire to learn or grit.
Why not? Those seem like useful concepts.
That can be descriptive, sure. But saying a student studies because they have grit doesn't tell you how to help a student who isn't studying. It doesn't give you anything to change.
So behaviorists live for?
Observable, manipulable variables in the environment. That includes the internal physiological environment, like being hungry or tired, and the external environment, things we can actually measure and change.
Okay, so instead of desire, you look at principles like the PREMAC principle, grandma's rule.
That's a classic, yeah. First, eat your vegetables, low probability behavior. Then you can have dessert, high probability behavior, using the preferred activity to reinforce the less preferred one.
Simple enough?
But it gets much more sophisticated. Take the response deprivation hypothesis, or RDH. This one is fascinating.
Okay, RDH. This sounds technical.
It is, but the core idea is kind of mind-bending. RDH basically says if you restrict access to a behavior below its normal frequency.
So you limit something the person normally does.
Right. Doing that actually increases its value as a reinforcer. It makes the person want to do it more, and you can use access to it to strengthen other behaviors.
Wait, so?
Yeah.
You could theoretically make eating vegetables reinforce eating dessert if you, like, really restricted access to broccoli.
Theoretically, yes. If someone normally eats a certain amount of broccoli and you restrict access significantly, access to broccoli could function as a reinforcer for something else, even something they usually like more, like dessert. It's about the restriction relative to baseline.
That's wild. Does that actually work?
Oh, yeah. It's empirically shown. Classic example. Rats that normally run on a wheel will drink way more water than usual if drinking water is the only way they can gain access to the wheel, especially if they've been deprived of running.
Okay, so deprivation boosts value. That all ties into
motivating operations, right.
MOs.
Exactly. This is a really technical but powerful area. MOs are environmental variables that do two things simultaneously.
Two things. Okay, what are they?
First, they have a value-altering effect. They change how much you want something right now. This can be an establishing operation. EO makes you want it more, like food deprivation increases the value of food.
Or the opposite.
Or an abolishing operation, AO, makes you want it less, like being totally full satiated decreases the value of food.
Okay, value altering. Got it. What's the second effect?
The behavior altering effect. This is about whether the MO makes you more or less likely to do something to get the valuable thing.
Ah, okay.
So an EO has an evocative effect. It increases the likelihood of behaviors that have gotten you that thing in the past. Like being thirsty makes you more likely to go get water.
And an AO.
An AO has an ablative effect. It decreases those behaviors. If you just drank a ton of water, you're less likely to seek out more water right now.
So let's take thirst again. Being thirsty is the MO. It makes water more valuable. Value altering. And D makes you go look for water. Behavior alter.
Exactly. They work together. And these MOs can be unconditioned, like basic biological states, hunger, thirst, pain avoidance, or they can be conditioned, learned.
Like praise or grades or money.
Precisely. Those things have value because of our learning history. So far from ignoring motivation, behaviorism has a very detailed functional way of analyzing it.
Okay, that's clear. Which leads perfectly into the next big one. Misconception 5.
Yeah.
That behaviorists just ignore thoughts, feelings, cognition, everything inside the head.
Right. This really gets to a core difference in philosophy about causality.
How so?
Well, the more traditional cognitivist view often sees internal processes like working memory, attention, perception as the primary cause of behavior. They're the independent variable driving things.
Like information processing theory. Stimulus hits sensory memory, goes to working memory.
Exactly. So if there's a problem, say, in learning, the diagnosis often focuses on a problem inside that processing chain, like a perceptual deficit.
Whereas the behaviorist sees that internal stuff differently.
Yes. We see internal activity, thoughts, feelings, even neural firing as more behavior just happening inside the skin. Yeah. It's treated as a dependent variable. It's influenced by the environment, subject to the same principles as overt behavior.
Okay, so how does that play out practically? Let's take a reading issue, maybe a child reversing B and D.
Okay. A cognitivist might diagnose an underlying visual processing disorder or learning disability, something inferred inside the head.
And the behaviorist intervention.
We'd look at the observable stimulus error. What specific visual stimulus, the letter shape, is occasioning the wrong response? We wouldn't guess about internal processing.
So what do you do?
The intervention is direct teaching of the discrimination. Maybe teach D first to mastery, since it's more common. Then carefully introduce B, ensuring success, reinforcing correct responses, focus on changing the external stimuli and consequences.
Which avoids that kind of circular logic trap, right?
Exactly. That trap of saying he can't read because he has dyslexia. We know he has dyslexia because he can't read.
The label doesn't explain anything.
Right. It doesn't tell you the cause or what to do. Behaviorism demands we find variables we can actually manipulate to improve the skill.
And this practical focus, it even pushes back against some big developmental theories like Piaget stages.
It does. Piaget basically said development enables learning. You need to be in the concrete operational stage, say, to grasp certain math concepts.
Yeah.
Behaviorism flips it. Learning defines the stage. The repertoire of skills a child has learned through interaction with their environment is what we call their developmental stage.
And the implication there is huge for teaching.
Critical. You don't wait for a child to magically reach a stage to start teaching foundational skills. For reading, waiting until age 7 or later is often too late. We need systematic instruction in preschool on pre-reading skills to get kids reading by 3rd grade. You build the stage through teaching.
And it's clear this isn't just for, you know, training animals or highly specialized settings. These principles are working in mainstream human applications.
Absolutely. It's considered state of the art in many areas. Early intensive behavioral intervention, EIBI for autism, that's applied behavior analysis. Modern therapies like CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, and ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, have deep behavioral roots. Effective teaching methods like explicit instruction for learning disabilities rely heavily on behavioral principles.
And even large-scale school systems.
Yep. Things like PBIS, positive behavior interventions and supports, and MTSS, multi-tiered systems of support, are built on a foundation of behavior analysis.
Yeah.
It's really quite pervasive when you look closely.
Okay, let's kind of pull back for the bigger picture here. Thinking about what actually shapes behavior, moving towards Skinner's idea of selection by consequences, what are the main forces at play?
Skinner talked about 3 main forces shaping who we are and what we do. There's our physiology, our biology, genetics, internal state.
Okay, nature.
Then there's culture, the broader environment of social norms, language, the practices of the group we live in.
Nurture, sort of.
And finally, crucially, there's the past and immediate environment. This is about our direct learning history, the specific consequences that have followed our actions, and the stimuli present right now.
So physiology, culture, and environment learning history. For someone trying to actually change behavior, a teacher, a therapist, even ourselves, which one can we most effectively influence?
Hands down, it's the past or immediate environment. You can't easily change someone's basic biology or rewrite their entire cultural background.
Right.
But you can change the contingencies right now. You can change the cues, the prompts, the reinforcement available in this specific setting. That's where behavior analysis focuses its practical power.
And this is where that parallel to biology becomes so clear. Behaviorism as essentially applied evolution on an individual scale.
Skinner explicitly made that link, influenced by Darwin. Darwin described phylogeny, natural selection, shaping the evolution of the species over millennia based on environmental consequences, survival. Oh. Skinner described ontogeny, operant conditioning, shaping the behavior of the individual over their lifetime based on environmental consequences in their own experience. Selection by consequences operates on both levels.
Can you give an example of that ontogenetic selection?
Think about Thorndike's cats in the puzzle box. The cat makes lots of random movements at first, scratching, meowing, pacing. Those are like behavioral mutations.
Okay, trying different things.
Right. Behaviors that don't lead to escape, that don't work, they effectively extinguish, they become less likely. But then, maybe by chance, the cat hits the lever that opens the door.
Ah, success.
Exactly. That behavior hitting the lever is immediately reinforced by escape. The consequence, getting out, selects for that specific action. Next time, the cat is much more likely to hit the lever sooner.
The effective behavior survives and strengthens.
Precisely. Reinforcement is, in a very real sense, survival for that behavior. Extinction is failure. It's applied evolutionary biology in miniature.
That really frames it differently. It's not about good or bad behavior, but effective versus ineffective behavior selected by the environment.
That's the core idea.
So recapping our deep dive, we've seen behaviorism isn't just simplistic SR psychology, it's SRS. It doesn't inherently rely on punishment. Modern ethics prioritize reinforcement. That awful Skinner box myth is just that, a myth.
Mm-hmm.
And behaviorism doesn't ignore motivation or cognition. It just defines and studies them through observable functional relationships, avoiding circular labels. The focus shifts from blaming internal flaws like lack of willpower to scientifically designing the immediate environment.
And that shift is incredibly empowering, I think. If you're trying to learn something, teach someone, or change a habit, understanding that behavior is shaped by these manipulable environmental variables, the MOs, the contingencies, the stimuli.
It gives you actual tools.
It gives you actionable strategies. You're not just hoping for some internal state to change. You're actively engineering the conditions for success.
Which brings us to a final thought for you, the listener. Since your behavior, all behavior, is constantly being shaped by this process of selection by consequences, take a moment to think about a skill or habit you're currently working on. Look closely at your immediate environment related to that skill. What specific consequences, maybe subtle ones, are actually happening right after you try? Are those consequences selecting for the behavior you want? Or are they inadvertently extinguishing it, or maybe reinforcing procrastination or avoidance?
Is your environment truly set up to reinforce your goals?
Something to consider. We'll leave you with that.